My name is Jess Graham, and I'm the community builder at the Transnational Institute, and I'm here to ask for your help. The work of TNI is important and cannot be done without financial resources. If you like the work we do, I encourage you to support TNI. You will help us to continue strengthening international social movements with research, reliable information, sound analysis, and constructive proposals that advance progressive, democratic policy change and common solutions to global problems. We need your help to retain a loud and independent voice in this environment. Please go to tni.org and at the top of the page, click Support Us. You can make a one-off donation or sign up as a friend of TNI and pledge a regular contribution that will help us to continue the vital work being done. Thanks a lot.
For the last 2 years, Lebanon has been witnessing an acute multidimensional crisis that has left more than half the population living below the poverty line. Many families are struggling to survive. Some say that the massive economic crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic, the August 2020 Beirut explosions, and constant instability have all combined to create conditions even worse than they were during the 1975 to 1990 civil war. In October 2019, Lebanon also saw a mass uprising, rejecting corruption and sectarian politics and demanding change. However, the uprising was short-lived for various reasons, including the onset of the pandemic in early 2020 that halted mobilizations and protests. To add to all these huge difficulties and challenges, the Lebanese people find themselves in the midst of a thorny and complex geopolitical situation that has significant bearings on their internal politics. The actions of players such as Hezbollah, Iran, Israel, the Gulf monarchies, Western imperialist powers, and Russia have had and continue to have considerable consequences on political developments, not just in Lebanon, but in the entire Arab region. To help us understand the situation in Lebanon, the coordinator of TNI's North Africa program, Hamza Hamushen, sat down to have a chat with Hicham Safidin. Hicham is an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. He's a scholar of political economy and intellectual history of the 19th and 20th centuries, with a particular emphasis on the Middle East and North African region. He's currently researching financial decolonization on a global scale, the history of economic thought, as well as modern Arab and Islamic thought, with an emphasis on the age of anti-colonial national liberation in the mid-20th century. In addition to his academic research and teaching, he's the co-founder of the eZines Al Akbar English and the Legal Agendas English edition. His press writings have appeared in the Toronto Star, Al Jazeera English, The Monthly Review, Le Monde Diplomatique, and Middle East Eye, among others. Hamza began by asking Hicham to outline what exactly is going on in Lebanon at the moment.
Lebanon is going through an unprecedented economic collapse, which the World Bank has said may be one of the worst in modern times. The Lebanese currency has lost more than 90% of its value against the US dollar since 2019, and the country is in the top five most indebted countries in the world. At the outset of this crisis, we have the public debt that is estimated to be one and a half the size of the economy. First of all, can you start by briefly describing what that means on the ground for Lebanese people?
As some of the listeners would know, as you pointed out, this has been happening for 2 years. So the impact of the crisis is changing over time. And this change is a result of the measures taken or those not taken by the authorities to handle the crisis. At the very beginning, of course, before this crisis happened, there were already financial difficulties faced by many people, but it hadn't hit home until this bankruptcy took place. The main impact that's happened is the following. Firstly, because of these high rates of inflation, prices have gone up, and this happened in tandem with the inability of many people, particularly the middle class, which is the hardest hit in relative terms, of course, to access the money in the banks. So the closure of the banks and the stoppage of payment by the banks has meant that the savings of a large majority of Lebanon's middle class have evaporated, which meant that they've had to actually either reduce and drastically change their livelihood in terms of everything from their diet to their ability to access healthcare, to their ability to actually get proper education for their children, to the very basics of actually, obviously, providing for themselves in terms of food, and even in terms of shelter, rent, et cetera. So this had a very direct impact on their ability to maintain a certain standard of life, although the standard of life, I always say in my interviews, remains relatively better than many other parts of the world, particularly in the Global South, of course, because of the relatively high standard of life that many Lebanese were living. So the devaluation of the currency, the stoppage of payment means lack of access to savings and on the financial and economic level. This has also meant that because Lebanon relies a lot on imports, the majority of Lebanese consumption is coming from abroad because of the structure of Lebanon's economy, that the shortages in US dollars has meant a lot of medication and other amenities are not anymore available. So that's another major impact. And this has resulted in addition to the impoverishment of many Lebanese, an increased return to emigration. So an exodus of a large number of Lebanese people, particularly the young people who don't have employment, who are unable actually to survive, don't have any kind of security, and that's why they are looking for opportunities to leave. So this is really, in short, from a financial point of view, the main impact this has had on people. And I want to stress, when we say people in Lebanon, Lebanon is also home to hundreds of thousands of Palestinian and Syrian refugees. And so also this has impacted them as well. So it's about the people who live in Lebanon, not just the Lebanese people. Now, there is actually, like any crisis, as you know, Hamza, in the world, financial or economic crisis, there are also some winners. We always have, with impoverishment, enrichment. And we have seen people who get paid in so-called fresh dollars, who are able to obtain fresh dollar money. We have seen the rise of a new class. So in addition to the wealthy oligarchy of Lebanon that continue to control Lebanese financial system because they managed to smuggle some of the money out of Lebanon, we can talk about that later, you do have a new kind of small class of NGOs, many of whom, by the way, are part of the, or speak on behalf of the uprising, who are paid in also US dollars, and also some political parties who get paid in US dollars, although to a lesser extent, like Hezbollah, they are now better off. So I know many people myself, individuals, journalists, civil society, they now live a much better life, ironically, financially speaking. But of course, they suffer from the general malaise and the insecurity and the problems facing Lebanon, like also I haven't mentioned this, the shortages in electricity, the shortages in fuel. So these are also more recent developments. As the currency reserves of Lebanon dwindle, the more they dwindle, the more things will become unavailable. In this case, in the last few months, Lebanon has witnessed a major shortages in electricity and major shortages in fuel, which is a result of its inability to import fuel, plus the presence of a cartel of fuel importers who are controlling the distribution of fuel, which also plays into the geopolitics, which is something we might talk about as well.
Yeah, we will get back to this in more details later. But I just want to tackle one important point, because not just in Lebanon, but in many parts of the Arab region and in the Global South as well, when we have those crises, we have those explanations from some observers and pundits trying to explain these crises by endemic corruption, sheer mismanagement and bad governance, by deeply entrenched authoritarian or sectarian systems. In the case of Lebanon, some people also blame American sanctions, while others point the finger at the pandemic. So what is your take, Hisham? Basically, how did Lebanon reach this low?
So there are two, I think, issues to your question. The first is the general argument about corruption, which also, as you know, is always connected to this idea of good governance versus bad governance. Mm. This is something we see, as you said, across not just the Arab region, but the global south. So this is something I'd like to say something about first. The second question that you talked about is the cause for this crisis. And as a historian, I tend to say it's rarely the case in history that we have a monocausal explanation. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a primary and secondary contradiction. Mm-hmm. And this is where the problem lies, actually, in much of the debate we are hearing around us today. Mm-hmm. So either you explain what happened by a single cause, or you say everything caused it. And in both cases, I think we are not doing justice to the situation. So let me first address the point you raised about corruption and bad governance, which is always, you know, assigned to the global south. You know, there's always this idea of the, you know, the global south elite. They are despotic or sectarian. And now all of these things, again, are true in many cases, particularly, you know, after the decline in the early stages of the national liberation movements and the entrenchment of neoliberalism in these countries, which led to a large degree of corruption of many of the leaders who were actually some of them part of the movements for national liberation. But the main point is, to what extent is really the problem simply a question of corruption? In the case of Lebanon, at the very least, actually the main cause is a structural cause on two levels. The first is the economic structure, which is extremely unbalanced and which actually relies highly on the services sector, which is an intentional policy by successive Lebanese governments to maintain this free market economy in order to benefit a minority of importers. So the exchange rate was fixed in Lebanon historically constantly at an overvalued pace to favor importation, which meant it had harmed production, which, by the way, should we have any crisis, if we had a minimal level of production, we could have at least, or Lebanon could have at least, avoided this steep shortage in commodities. So that's the first point. The second point is there is a major problem in Lebanon, which is debt that you mentioned. Mm. Now, people like to, when they talk about corruption, observers, they like to focus, for example, on spending, government spending. And usually they'll tell you, you know, they spend so much on public wages, which is here where neoliberalism and austerity comes in, how this idea of corruption is used to further implement austerity, because they say the government is spending so much money on public wages, there's inefficiency in the public sector, we need to cut down the public sector. The government is spending and wasting $1 billion in the case of Lebanon on electricity. The power system doesn't work, let's privatize. Mm. As a matter of fact, if you look at the numbers, because sometimes we are accused as people who introduce a Marxist or a critical political economy perspective that we just talk about slogans. In the case of Lebanon, close to half or 35% of government expenditure from the 90s until today, more so actually in the last 10 years, I should say, and specifically by 2018, before the crisis, before the collapse happened, is on public debt, is on interest rate. So, you know, and this is by law, it's not corruption. The government is paying interest rate on its debt, which it owes to the private banks. Compare that to, you know, 10% expenditure on electricity. And compare that probably to around, if I remember correctly, 20% for public wages. And remember that public wages are benefiting probably tens of thousands of families if you divided their person, whereas the debt servicing is benefiting 1% of the population. And it's an unproductive expenditure. Whereas you could argue if you provide electricity, people can actually, factories can work. There are no factories in Lebanon, no big ones. So my point is, the biggest source of waste in the case of Lebanon is public debt, the servicing of public debt, and not other forms of waste, although other forms of waste do exist. So this is to counter this argument that it's simply a question of corruption. Actually, it's a question of a structural economic and financial system, which is blessed usually. Most of the time, it is blessed by the IMF. It is blessed by Western economic pundits. That's the first point about corruption. Let's turn to the second, more controversial and thorny question, of what caused this crisis. Now, again, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to speak about this without rush, because today the conversation is so politicized in the negative sense. It is about propaganda in also a very negative sense of the word, in the sense that the majority of people talking about, in my opinion, talking about Lebanon, they have an enemy in mind. They have a political party or political actor in mind. And all they care about really is to attack that party. So those who only want us to believe that this is purely an American or, you know, sanctions regime, which is mostly, of course, Hezbollah and its allies. They, in my opinion, they're not interested in transforming the Lebanese free market economy. They will tell you, by the way, to be fair, that there are other reasons for this. But the only thing they want us to focus on is the American sanction system. And in the case of Lebanon, the structural problems I talked about predate the sanctions regime. So we cannot actually say that this is the major cause of the crisis. On the other hand, many parties, actors, observers who are, you know, want to blame everything on Hezbollah, they really don't care to look at the facts. They also pay lip service to resistance to Palestine, because whether we like it or not, for instance, they have a grudge against Hezbollah, and maybe rightly so in the case of Syria. They don't care that much about, or they pay lip service to the question of armed struggle against Israel. They will, you know, continue to dismiss the sanctions or not discuss it. And also, this is, in my opinion, a misleading interpretation. So in my view, the primary fundamental cause of this crisis is the financial and economic structure of the Lebanese economy. But, and this is an important but, Lebanon is not the only country that suffers from high levels, as you mentioned, of debt, although it's one of the highest. And also Lebanon, remember, is a small economy, which means that as huge as these losses are relative to the Lebanese economy and population, they're really not as big compared to what can other countries do. So what does this mean? This means that if the current Lebanese government were not closer to Hezbollah and its allies, if Lebanon were much more closer to the Western and the Gulf regime camp, it is possible that the Gulf regime would have regimes would have intervened and given Lebanon some money to actually, you know, facilitate the crisis. They are doing the exact opposite. The Saudi Arabia was more than happy to provide Egypt and the Sisi regime with billions of dollars of money. So it's not true that, you know, this we can only reduce this to a financial issue. The American sanctions on the banking system, by the way, and this is the irony of all of this, has harmed the banking system, but it hasn't harmed actually Hezbollah. So my point is that with like any case of disaster capitalism, we have a very fragile and uneven economic and financial system, and that is the root cause, but we do have very active attempts. It's not, you know, we cannot exonerate the Western powers. There's an active attempt by the United States in cahoots with Israel and Saudi Arabia and the UAE and other parties to actually bring the Lebanese government to the ground in order to change the balance of power against Hezbollah. And again, the opposition to Hezbollah in this case has nothing to do with Hezbollah's domestic policy, which I think is no better than others, but has everything to do with Hezbollah's position and resistance against Israel and its intervention in the region against US interests.
Thanks for this very comprehensive answer, Hisham. Very well put, and I think there is a lot of elements to grapple with there. But let's go into more details to the political situation right now. So there has been a kind of political paralysis in Lebanon for almost, I think, for more than a year, following last year's catastrophic Beirut port blast, one of the biggest non-nuclear explosion in history. It seems you are very good in accumulating records.
We have the biggest hummus as well in the Guinness Book of Records. Hummus plate, I think. I mean, yeah. It's not, you know, I regret, you know, with the situation, tragic, what happened was super tragic. So, but yes, we do have these records, shameful records, yes.
Yeah, you said the situation has been very tragic. We had like 218 casualties and more than 7,000 injuries, plus disastrous material damage to the city and infrastructure. And since then, Lebanon has been without a functioning government for 13 months. Can you explain to the listener the reasons for this political deadlock and what happened exactly with the port blasts and who is responsible for this deadly event? And it would be good as well to mention to the listener what happened today on the 14th of October in Beirut with some violent events in relation to the blast.
Before we get to the port, and as you know, and I think, you know, we might talk about this, that there now is a government was formed, and ironically, it was formed in record speed compared to, as you mentioned, the extended deadlock in the last round. So just for those who are not as familiar with Lebanese politics and for right reasons may find themselves a bit perplexed, I won't go into the details of the negotiations over the formation of the cabinet, the former cabinet, because a lot of it is about a tussle over who is appointed which minister between the different parties. That's the kind of, you know, day-to-day cause. Like the different factions could not agree on the names of the ministers and on the division of ministers between different sects. And so this is something that has always been the case in Lebanon. But there is something more important, more fundamental, that has happened since the assassination of Hariri. This is not the first time, by the way, that this happens, meaning that Lebanon stays without a prime minister for a very extended period of time, nor in the past, it has also stayed without a president The point is that there is more frequency. This paralysis has become more frequent since 2005. So regardless of the sectarian division, which always been the case, they've always, you know, tussled over these things in the past. Usually it takes, you know, I don't know, a few weeks, months, and then things work. But since 2005, we have seen this happen over and over again. Now, the explanation is the following. Lebanon has always had a power-sharing arrangement between its different sectarian elites. I always stress that, sectarian bourgeoisie. But there's always been an external actor that played a role in keeping tabs. So, you know, all proclamations to the contrary, Lebanon was one of the least sovereign country in the world, and the most one that sovereignty is invoked by especially reactionary forces, which shows you usually when you keep saying that you have something, it means you don't have it. So in the case of Lebanon, after the civil war in 1990, there were the Taif Accords, which actually shifted the executive power from the Lebanese Maronite president to the Council of Ministers. A lot of people, when they discuss the Taif, they focus on the prime minister, that there was a shift from the president to the prime minister, Sunni prime minister. The president, this is custom, this is not law. The president has to be Maronite, the prime minister has to be Sunni, and the Speaker of Parliament has to be Shia. So before the war, executive power was largely in the hands of the Maronite president. As a result of the war and the intervention by external actors, particularly Saudi, Syria, and the United States, you have a new arrangement where the Council of Ministers becomes the executive body, which means that, by the way, you need a majority in the Council of Ministers to execute things. Now, this meant that the sectarian power sharing was devolved from a single authority, the president, to all factions. From the 1990 to 2005, anytime there was a conflict, Damascus intervened because it was the guardian, so to speak, the force that had say in the day-to-day. And there was some Saudi-Syrian agreement, arrangement, so there wasn't any really big disagreements. After the killing of Hariri and the withdrawal of Syrian forces from Lebanon, there was no more a single external hegemon managing this, which meant that any disagreement between the factions could go on forever if they don't agree. And this is what's been happening in general terms. You know, I could again talk about the specifics of this last government, but really this is the explaining the structure, why we have these repetitive, prolonged formations of government.
And then can you tell the listeners about the violent events that took place today?
Yes, the port, sorry. Yeah. So unfortunately, and again, I'm not on the ground. I've been in touch with my friend journalists who are on the ground. So I've managed to get some information, but I cannot speak to the specifics, particularly because of what is, we talk about the fog of war at the moment. And I'm very careful to say, we should be very careful in interpreting these events because A, they're very fresh, and B, there's again, so many attempts by the media to actually mislead people. You know, the media in Lebanon, like many other places, is largely, you know, completely beholden to political factions. Or the NGOs, I don't exclude civil society from this. Without, of course, the big blame is on the people ruling the country, but I mean in terms of how they approach the event. So what happened today, this is the port explosion. You asked me about the port explosion.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't know. I can, you know, I have my own hypothesis about what happened. But like many other crimes committed in Lebanon, because this is a crime, whether by negligence or otherwise, we are not able to have a proper investigation. We, you know, from the very beginning, the precautions and procedures required for a proper investigation were not respected. And also the judicial system in Lebanon is extremely politicized. It's, you know, has very little independence. Also the foreign judicial system is no better. We had a trial of Hariri 2005. It was a kangaroo court. At the time, it was really intended to simply punish the Syrian and Hezbollah at the time. So there's a precedent to being very cynical and skeptical about any investigation. Now, that being said, it looks like from the work done by good journalists who have been working hard on this, the most prominent one in Lebanon is Riyad Ebaisi, is that it is very possible that this was a case of criminal negligence. I mean, this might sound, you know, a little bit puzzling, but no. If anyone knows how the system in Lebanon works, I know it could be that. It could be. Now, I'm not going to eliminate, you know, the possibility of, you know, some form of intervention or like a criminal intention. But my point is, regardless, I mean, because again, there are many levels to this. There's who brought in the ammonium nitrate, what was it being used for, why was it put there, why didn't, and I don't want to bore the listener. I'll just say one example. Imagine, Hamza, there were people, individuals in the customs office who were trying to sell this material, not to move it to a safe place. You know, let it there, let's sell it so we can make money out of it. So my point is, it could be that kind of that the reason. Now, regardless, the point is, at this stage, we do have a judge who's actually conducting an investigation. Mm-hmm. His name is Tar El-Bitar, which is the second judge, because the first judge was accused of bias and was recused. So this second judge, generally speaking, there is very little, no one has actually managed to make any claims about him being corrupt. He's known to be a very straightforward judge. He's known to have an impeccable record. So on an individual basis, no one has been able to provide any evidence that this judge is a corrupt judge. However, the level of secrecy of the investigation, because that's what the law says at this point, has meant that we don't know enough about what the judge is doing. All we know is that he is issuing subpoenas to political figures in order to listen to their testimony. And I think in a couple of cases, he's like, you know, he's pressed charges. I don't know for sure, actually. Actually, I think he's pressing charges on those who are refusing to appear before court.
All right.
That's what's happening. So this has been going on for a while now, for several months. And it also happens, and this is not also, and so what has happened since then is that a large number of those who were actually subpoenaed, if I'm using the right legal word, by the judge, are closer to the camp of the Free Patriotic, of Hezbollah. Let me put it that way. Again, for the lack of, because there were two camps in Lebanon after the accession of Hariri, March 14 and March 8. These camps they kind of like, they're very malleable these days, very porous. They're not as strictly formed as they used to be. So it's harder now to say camp March 14, March 8. But there is still some division. And by the way, this is the, and we'll get to this on geopolitics. This division is geopolitical. It's not about what to do in the country. I mean, neither party are that interested in reforming the Lebanese economic system. So which tells us that we cannot dismiss geopolitics. So anyways, the point is, in this case, the Hezbollah has, for some reason, and I think it's unjustifiable at this point, has decided to, you know, be the, spearhead of the attack on the judge.
Right.
So in a couple of days ago, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, came out. And by the way, I'm always wary of talking about Hezbollah because of the way the Western media is always attacking it and demonizing it. But this is why I'm happy that we're having a longer conversation, so it's not taken out of context, because it is important for us to always emphasize and support armed struggle as a way of denying those who simply want to attack it for that from using what we critique as a way to actually undermine the struggle against Israel. So anyways, after this caveat, Nasrallah decided, in my view, unjustifiably, to attack the judge. And, you know, he hasn't provided so far strong evidence. Unlike 2005, when the international investigation was clearly misusing and abusing the case. And in that, at that time, they actually offered counter evidence eventually. But the point is that this attack on the judge prompted a demonstration today against the judge. And when people went out to demonstrate, which again, I always think is ill-advised, there's no justification for this demonstration. But it doesn't mean we can prevent people from going down if, you know, they're protesting peacefully. But I find it very irresponsible, actually, to call for such a demonstration. Then we had snipers, and all reports I'm reading are snipers coming from the phalanges, the Christian phalanges. Again, these are reports at this stage. I cannot confirm or deny them because I wasn't there. But there was a brutal, deadly attack and the killing of people who were demonstrating. And this triggered the incoming of armed groups affiliated with Amal movement and Hezbollah from the north, down to Beirut, and this escalated into clashes in the streets between these two groups, and then the army, the Lebanese army, intervened. So this is, in a nutshell, what happened and why it happened today.
Really hope that things won't escalate further, causing more deaths or loss of life. You mentioned in your previous answer, the formation of a new government. So last month, we had Najib Mikati, a billionaire telecoms tycoon who has been premier twice before, has been appointed the new prime minister. Among the first things he has done is to reach out to the IMF for $1 billion loan. Some observers say that the sum is too small to resolve Lebanon's economic problems, but regardless, isn't that yet another bad move for Lebanese working people who would face more austerity measures, and for the country in general, who would suffer through more debt servitude, as you mentioned previously?
Firstly, just to add, there are certain, just a quick addition about the investigation. The biggest point of contention today is the head of the Lebanese army, Joseph Aoun, who is now increasingly closer to the ambassador, U.S.-American ambassador. And the U.S. is pumping millions and millions of dollars into Lebanon to the Lebanese army and to NGOs to counter, the Hezbollah presence and influence of other countries like Iran. But the point is, there are few things that remain to be seen about the judge, and it is legitimate for us to question the judge's procedures, especially those who have expertise in the legal matters, because there is this question mark about why hasn't the judge actually called on the head of the Lebanese army. Now, there are maybe legal explanations for that, But what I'm trying to say is there is good reason to be cautiously cynical about any investigation in Lebanon because of the total lack of judicial independence. But there is no smoking gun right now. And without that, it is irresponsible and unfair. And I'll tell you why very briefly, because those opposing this judge's investigation, they don't want a better investigation. What's happening in Lebanon is this ruling class, they don't want any accountability, impunity. And actually, most of them are warlords, you know, hailing back from the Lebanese civil war, plus the oligarchs that Hariri brought in with him in the 90s. So my point is, if you are claiming to oppose him because, like I'm saying, there are loopholes, actually, you should be actually seeking proper accountability. But that's not the case. It's actually, you just don't want any accountability. And you may say it is because we want stability in Lebanon, because this will, you know, lead again to undermining our struggle against Israel. But then the point is, I am sorry, the explosion in Beirut is not a detail and it's not a small incident. And we cannot deal with it the same way we deal with the assassination of a political figure like Hariri. Sorry for this long, but I think necessary addition. Now, to go to your point about the new government, I did write a piece about this government in more detail, if those are, who are interested in the makeup of the government, how it's connected to global capital. You're absolutely right. This government is actually worse than its predecessor, the Hassanian government, which, by the way, reminds me again of the way in which many people just want to critique everything without making differentiation so we can understand what's happening, and sometimes in the left. So this government is mostly people who are connected to the banking oligarchy, people who are connected to the international financial institutions like the IMF, including the deputy prime minister. As you mentioned, it's the prime minister himself is a big tycoon, one of the richest men in Lebanon and the world, coming from the poorest country in the Mediterranean, city, Tripoli. This is, you know, he hails from Tripoli in Lebanon, which actually is home to two of Lebanon's richest men, Hamad al-Safadi and Najib Mikati. So you see the disparity, the incredible disparity between, you know, this oligarchy, and I think it's so ironic that he's coming from that city. So this government, the mandate of this government is likely to be implementing IMF austerity, which means possible, instead of confiscating the property and capital of the bank stockholders, the owners of the banks, and redistributing them to the depositors, which, by the way, is not a Marxist or leftist action. It's really very basic capitalist bail-in. It's actually, well, it's a standardized method of liquidating and restructuring any banking system. So they don't want to even do that. Instead, they are hoping, the banking oligarchy and these political leaders, that they can actually privatize whatever is left of the Lebanese state assets and use that to then pay off the depositors so they can keep their own money. They will also seek to stabilize the exchange rate, which is a good thing. We do need that. But we don't know at which rate, and we don't know if they're going to introduce adjustments to salaries and other income of working class people to accommodate the change. Now, they do have something called a cash assistance program. Mm. But we know what these mean. These mean that we're going to give you some change money in return for this huge redistribution of wealth, rather than, for example, promising a public healthcare system free for everybody, or rather than for, and these are, of course, these measures are not simply the Lebanese measures, these are IMF measures. It's just that in Lebanon, the complete lack of accountability means that they're going to have probably an extreme form of austerity, if it happens. Now, what happened yesterday is going to shuffle the cards. I mean, the idea was this was going to be a phase of relative calm until the elections. That's another thing we haven't talked about, in 2022. What we see today on the street, what we are seeing today in the government, is a run-up, warm-up for the elections. And the elections, the United States, you know, just to tell listeners so they understand, today the majority in parliament is with the Hezbollah camp. Maybe many people don't realize that. Mm. And that's why they were able to actually name the prime ministers. So from the point of view of the United States doesn't see any of these details we're talking about. The United States and each country, you know, they have a policy, foreign policy. We want somebody in the country who is our ally, and we will fight those who are not our allies by any means necessary, whether through clandestine agitation, coups, the democratic elections, co-optation of whatever. In the case of Lebanon, there are very explicit actions taken to turn this around. So they're trying to create a coalition, the United States, between reactionary existing ruling class factions and up and coming civil society NGO type people in the hope that they can overturn this majority in the next election. So what we are seeing in the next, what we are seeing now and we will continue to see is actually all up until the elections of May 2022. Which we don't know if they will happen or not. Again, right? If the situation deteriorates, there may be a suspension of election. But that's the target that the United States is aiming for, and that the local parties, obviously, once this is the case, you know, they themselves also are looking for this opportunity to renew their mandate, or in, if they don't think they're going to win, to actually sabotage the election.
Mm. So Hisham, it is estimated that the central bank, the Lebanese central bank, losses stand at $80 billion. And this is connected to what has been referred to as a Ponzi scheme between the central bank, the government, and the private banking sector. In fact, one of the demands of the October 2019 Lebanon uprising was the downfall of the bank's power, which has been seen as part of the problem. Can you shed some light on this for our listeners?
So again, briefly, the cycle of the transfer of assets or capital in the Lebanese financial and banking system is as follows. You have large deposits by local and actually mostly expatriate people putting their money in the banks because there's secrecy, banking secrecy in Lebanon. This is why at some point the banking the assets of banks or the, I would not say assets, the deposits, bank deposits were almost four times the GDP, which is a very unhealthy economy. Now, the bulk of this money then, rather than it being invested in long-term productive projects, is largely invested either in imports, so trade, finance of trade, and one-way trade, I should point out, or mostly in the last, let's say, 20 years, in sovereign debt, in bonds, in government debt. So the bulk of this money now becomes deposited in the central bank. The central bank then uses this money to do two main things. Finance government expenditure, which again, a lot of it is paying the debt, the interest on the debt. And financing corrupt deals for building infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And defending the high rate of exchange. So this is the cycle that has led, but eventually all of this money is being, as I said, either paid to it in interest on paper, there's no real money, or wasted, or spent actually in the exchange market. And we don't know at this point, this is the biggest problem. We know and we don't know. We don't have any official audit of the central bank. This is one of the demands of many people. And some political parties, to be fair, including, for example, the Free Patriotic Movement or Hezbollah. So although its ally, Harakat Amal, does not want it. So this is here where the complications lie. The point is that we don't have an audit, but we know that the losses that you've mentioned are a result of the cycle that I just discussed. Mm-hmm. And unless and until there is a distribution of losses and the recuperation of profits, you will continue to have this problem. And there was an attempt to do that in the Hassan Diab government, the government that preceded this government. But it was sabotaged by the banking oligarchy that actually attacked it and claimed that it is inaccurate. So this is, I think that's what you were asking about. This is the cycle that is created this financial and this huge losses. And the central bank was hiding the losses as future revenue. It was hiding it by saying it's going to recuperate it in the future. So if you look at the balance sheet, you see other assets. It's only after the crisis. And actually, just recently, by the way, there are reports that the central bank government, Iyad Salemi, asked the IMF to actually redact, to cancel out large sections of its report in 2016 or 18, wow, which indicated the losses of the central bank. So there's a bit of a scandal recently, among other things he's doing. And also, we didn't talk about capital control, the fact that these rich people, instead of imposing capital control, Lebanon lost, at least by official accounts, $7 billion. So today, I forgot to mention what you mentioned, the $1 billion from the IMF, that's SDR, special drawing rights. This is not a loan, really. It's more like a free loan in a way because of the COVID. So this is a fallout that Lebanon got. So the strategy of these people in power now is we keep finding ways to pass on our losses to the middle and lower classes. I mean, the classes now they're suffering from inflation. The poor classes, working class, well, working is, you know, the middle, the salaried class is suffering from inflation and loss of savings. Because, and we haven't mentioned this, but I think most people know by now, if you have your money in dollars in the bank, you are getting them in Lebanese pounds now at a lower rate than the rate of the market.
So you're losing.
So that's how they are passing on the losses to the 99%.
Incredible. Incredible. The situation is complex, but it's great to have you here, Hisham, to help us understand the situation even better. But let's come back to the impact of the current economic crisis. We've seen, as for myself, I read a lot in the news, how Lebanese people have been dealing with shortages of medications and basic goods, including fuel, for months. Electricity has become increasingly scarce. 40% of the budget deficit is due to electricity. Can you describe to our listeners the impacts of the fuel and electricity shortages? Basically, how are Lebanese people living through this?
All right, so first, it's not true that it's 40%, unless this is a new number. Like I mentioned in the beginning, now the public debt is changing over time because there was a stoppage of payment. So maybe now it is 40%, Hamza, because they've stopped paying the debt or the servicing the debt. But just to remind people, the largest expenditure before the crisis erupted was public debt and interest paid on the debt. So just 10% was going to electricity. Around 35% in 2018 was going to public debt. But it is possible, was this like recent, the 40%? Or I don't know, when was this stated?
I think I've read it in The Guardian, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, so it's possible that now this is the case because they stopped paying the debt. They defaulted on the debt last year. This is just to say again that the main problem is not it is a problem, but it's not the main problem. Now, what was the question again about the electricity and the fuel?
Yeah, how are the Lebanese people living through the shortages of electricity?
Well, I was in Lebanon for a while during the height of the crisis in the summer. And I can tell you personally, literally, you couldn't, with the fuel shortages, there is a large majority of the Lebanese who are standing in line were for hours to get fuel. Kind of similar, ironically, to what happened in Britain, which, you know, people were joking in Lebanon about how the crisis has moved to Britain, but for different reasons. Which is a reminder, you know, this, when I saw the videos in Britain, I was reminded, this whole talk about somehow our part of the world is more violent and more corrupted. And yeah. I know that the moment these basic amenities and privileges are taken away from the people of Europe, they will turn to violence in an instant, like any other people. So my point is here not to exceptionalize anybody, but to say that there's nothing inherent. If they had to put up with half of what people in Syria or Palestine or Lebanon or Algeria or Egypt had to do, you know, I mean, we know what happened 50 or 70 years ago or 80 years ago with World War II. So no one should come and tell us, you know, somehow, you know, they are more civilized or more, you know, less emotional and more prone to obeying the law. Anyways, to go back to Lebanon, people, myself included, I could not go anywhere without thinking and having to wait and you know, living. There was an anxiety, a daily anxiety that was extremely intolerable, because it's not that you just couldn't go somewhere. You never knew. You know, one day you could have fuel, one day you don't have fuel. If you have to go to work, some people actually quit their job because they couldn't go. They were living in Tripoli, they worked in Beirut, they had to quit their job, or they were spending more money on fuel than they were getting out of their job. So it made more sense for them to quit their job. There was a lot of people who died because of the clashes, because some, you know, armed people would. Lebanon, it's not just the political parties that are armed. People are. It's like the U.S. You know, everybody has weapons. So people were coming to stations and you know, jumping the queue. Some people were driving. You know, the families. There's one family that died, woman and her children, because somebody was driving in the opposite direction to basically get to a station. So electricity, you couldn't work if you are dependent on internet or laptop. I had to rely on whatever time I had to get things done. People who actually work in any place that requires some electricity was stopped. You couldn't sleep at night because of the heat, because, you know, especially urban areas. So your entire life was turned upside down. There was a huge impact. And there was a black, you know, so-called informal market was created. So, and now, by the way, they deregulated the price of fuel. But notice what happened. Because of the pressures that people faced, many of them started saying, let them just deregulate. Enough is enough. Wow. So nothing, there was no protest after deregulation.
Disaster capitalism.
So now what do you have? Rich people can afford to. I was always saying to people, I don't want deregulation, actually, until they break up the cartel. And also we can talk a bit about the US embargo and other extenuating circumstances. But the point is, no, let everybody suffer until we fix it. Because this is how you divide people, you know? So this is what happened.
Yeah, regarding the impacts, I read that a few days ago, I think it was last week, that several cities have been plunged into darkness because of outages for several days. So the situation is really getting bad. But in this context, several convoys carrying Iranian fuel have arrived in Lebanon under an initiative by the Islamist group Hezbollah to ease the country's crippling energy crisis. So we had the fuel coming from Iran, crossing the border from Syria, and being distributed by Hezbollah. All three are subject to US sanctions. So I'm just wondering, how did that happen? Was this delivery a kind of a political statement, a challenge to US sanctions on Iran, given that the United States has maintained an embargo against Iranian oil exports since previous President Trump pulled out of the 2015 nuclear agreement 3 years ago? Or is this simply, I don't know, a pragmatic move to relieve the energy crisis in Hezbollah strongholds and Lebanon's increase in desperation in general? So what is your take on this, Hisham?
So the first point is, yes, this was a political statement and a good political statement. And we should support that political statement, because there is no excuse and no justification for the United States to decide where Lebanon gets its fuel from. There is no why should we not get Iranian fuel? Under what basis is actually the United States denying the Lebanese people collectively and even, you know, factionally to not able to get fuel? So those who are protesting this move, well, why don't you go get fuel from the Western countries? You know, you don't want Hezbollah to go and get fuel from Iran, but then you don't want your allies to get you fuel. So I find this very objectionable. Now, and by the way, why should even they have to go through Banias? I mean, they had to do all of this to accommodate complaints by certain Lebanese factions that this is going to annoy the United States. And also because we know that if you don't do that, you may get a negative response from the United States. So they had to go to Banias, then, which is the port, the Syrian port on the Mediterranean, then travel all the way around and get through into Lebanon. And in terms of the distribution, yes, mostly it was managed by pro-Hezbollah groups, but you know, they did actually offer it to everybody. I don't know how I'm sure they gave, you know, their factions probably more, but I also shouldn't be so sure because I don't have the evidence. My point is, this move, however, as good as it is politically, does not solve the crisis, reinforces the clientelism and reliance on non-state actors to actually provide for the people. So there is a negative aspect to it, definitely, which is that it is relying and reinforcing. And this is how ironic It is for the United States, this stupid policy they have. So there is a negative aspect to it in that sense. It's also very minimal. It is not going to solve the bigger problem. And in my view, it is running, kicking the can forward. Because we have a cartel. We have a cartel that governs the import of fuel. This cartel should be dismantled. That is part of the problem. We can't just turn this into purely political issue between Iran and the United States. So on one hand, that was a good move. On another hand, it also skirted the fundamental problem, which is the shortage of dollars, which is the monopoly of distribution in the country. So, which is partly linked to the sanctions, but not entirely. So that's the point I think we have to make. Now, I think I wanted to say something about I forgot, to be honest. I don't know if there's something
Maybe the other plan to get gas from Egypt and Jordan and the implications for that when it comes to normalization with Israel. I know that you wrote about this. So yes. If you could say a little bit so we can understand the picture better.
Well, this question and the previous question, before I say some details about it, brings us to the larger question of what I call geoeconomics, which is just, a more kind of narrower interpretation of geopolitics. And this is, by the way, brings us to the whole point about discussing Lebanon in isolation of Syria, mm-hmm. or Syria in isolation of Lebanon, or in isolation of Palestine. Because this is what I'm sensing a lot of times, Hamza, unfortunately, yeah. is that, each faction or group, and here I'm talking about a lot of times discussion about imperialism, yeah. and colonialism. Actually, most people use imperialism. I'd rather use colonialism. That they just really, if you're, for example, opposed to Assad in Syria, and we've had this conversation, me and you, before, off the record, or under the air, you don't care. Somehow you're so vengeful or whatever. Not even that. I can understand if you're under fire, but intellectuals, we have intellectuals who, because of Hezbollah's intervention in Syria, they don't want to talk about the consequences of disarming the group, for example, or in southern Lebanon. What will happen to the people of southern Lebanon? And what will happen even to the Golan Heights? And to because they will say, but the Syrian regime is not doing anything in the Golan. But are you factoring in the liberation of the Golan in your analysis? And if you are, then how do you think that the United States is going to help you? On the other hand, also, people in South Lebanon, for example, they, in many respects, when you have a conversation, they don't want to think about the consequences of the large bombardment of people in Syria and the displacement that they are facing. So we have a dilemma here of how we analyze, and we are seeing day by day that the geopolitics and geoeconomics, whether we like it or not, is dictating outcomes, because the powerful parties involved, that's how they think. And unless we start thinking about it and incorporating it, not in a dismissive way, we don't want to talk about it, it's used. Democracy is always invoked by the West and by Bush to occupy Iraq. Do these people actually dismiss democracy because of that? And it's interesting that people who claim to be leftist and anti-imperialist seem to be a lot more concerned about questions of democracy, in the liberal sense, than material analysis. So we shouldn't be economistic. We cannot reduce struggle, but to dismiss material developments is the antithesis of historical materialist analysis. So the point about energy, which you mentioned, because of the shortage in Lebanon, there is now, and because of the incoming Iranian oil, the United States, which shows us that when we fight against U.S. policy, they don't always just use a stick, because the United States all of a sudden was willing to potentially allow gas and electricity to flow from Jordan and Egypt through Syria to Lebanon, which would potentially violate the Caesar Act, which was a sanctions against the Syrian people. So this happened, and you start now having negotiations last month in Amman between the governments of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. Now, what's the problem with this? Is that a lot of this, or at least part of this gas, is stolen Palestinian gas, because the Arab gas pipeline, which runs from Egypt in Al Arish, to Aqaba in Jordan, up north through Syria to Hummus, and then bifurcates into Banias and Tripoli. And by the way, was intended to go to Turkey and supply Europe with gas. So here we see how gas was part of the Syrian war, whether people like it or not. This gas now is going to be possibly mixed with Israeli-controlled gas that is being pumped from Palestine, the shores of Palestine, to Egypt, and also pumped through Palestine to Jordan, and also contributes to the generation of electricity in Jordan. So there's a concern that this is a form of normalization, that under the pretext of getting energy back to Lebanon, the United States is actually trying to integrate, further integrate Israeli gas systems into the Arab systems of generation of power and gas. And this is why it's very dangerous. But again, it is this dire economic situation. This is why, to me, we have to think of the economics of struggle against Israel. We cannot simply talk about just armed struggle, as important as that is. So yeah, this is in a nutshell. Again, I can go more details, but what is happening is a fear, concern of bringing in gas that is actually partly coming from Israeli sources.
And I think that's a good summary. And I really recommend to our listeners to go and read some of your articles around those questions, because they are really enlightening. You already mentioned this, so we are getting deep into the question of geopolitics and the regional dimension of Lebanese politics. We cannot just see, as you said, Lebanon or Lebanese politics as isolated or as an isolated case. We know of the West's obsession and antagonism with Iran and Hezbollah, who stand accused of all evil in the region. Just to inform our listeners, Hezbollah has been classified as a terrorist organization by the U.S. and other Western powers and has been the target of U.S. sanctions. What I'd like us to do right now, Hisham, is to try to briefly outline the important geopolitical actors, camps, and axes that have some bearings on Lebanese politics. You mentioned some of them, but it would be good to have more clarity about this and to give like a general idea to our audience.
Sure. So again, historically, this has always been the case. The most two powerful external actors that have had a say in Lebanon historically is the Zionist entity and Syria. And of course, by no means, and we should not, and this is sometimes done, equate the two. It's unacceptable to equate the two, because in my view, this one is a settler colonial state, imperialist arm, and the other is actually a country. You know, the problem is with some of the policy of the regime, but I would never say Syrian occupation of Syria. I find that laughable. It's a presence of, and I wouldn't say, for example, Egyptian occupation of Lebanon, or if Lebanese sent troops to, or Algeria, you know, this is part of the Arab societies, and also Iran is also part of this region. The same way like the people of the Gulf are, even if we oppose the regimes. So I want to make this distinction at the very beginning. But more recently, of course, and at different points in history, Egypt was influential. Of course, the United States is always present, and Saudi Arabia was always present. But the proximity of the Palestine and Syria is why these two countries have always had a major say in what happens in the country. Now, more recently, you know, this got complicated, but there are really two main, which is a reflection of what's happening in the rest of the region, but I will make some distinctions about how this plays out in Lebanon. Mm. You've got the main axis today of United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Although, of course, there are some differences between even now the UAE and Saudi, but this is the main axis on one hand. Mm-hmm. And then you've got another axis, which is Iran and Syria. And the first axis, their allies are usually Hariri, the Falanges, the Christian Falanges, and in many cases NGOs, although within NGOs, we have to be fair. Not everybody is, not everybody is a proxy of this. There are also other independents, but this is kind of, they're generally closer, although many people now pay lip service to being anti-Israel, but in terms of, you know, like practical policy, you know, it's just a way of speaking. Hmm. On the other hand, we have Iran and Syria, as I said, and there's Turkey, which is a third player. Turkey in Lebanon doesn't have much of a role the way it has in Syria, for example, because, you know, again, it doesn't have a foothold. It's trying to create a foothold in the north. It does a lot of work as well, charity work. So it's trying to create a foothold, but it's not a major player in terms of government formation. Now, Syria also, since the uprising in Syria and the war, has ceased to be, ironically, maybe the first time in history, we have a Lebanese actor, Hezbollah, possibly having, in many respects, sometimes a bigger say in Syria than Syria having in Lebanon. So this is, you know, interesting. And there may be a return, by the way, to the role of Syria and Lebanon. You know, people might be surprised. But this is just to say that these two camps are fighting in Lebanon. Now, unlike Syria, I would argue, where there is a direct role by Russia and in some cases Iran to aid an authoritarian regime, as much as I also understand that there are, you know, geopolitical reasons for that. In the case of Lebanon, you don't have a faction that we can say is opposed to like an authoritarian or sectarian system versus another faction that's not. So my point here is the domestic struggle in Lebanon, if you compare, let me put it in a different way, if you compare the objectives of these two camps, you'll find that both camps don't do well on the front of reforming the sectarian system.
Yeah.
Although financially and in the terms of banking, Hezbollah has a lot less role. Hezbollah is hegemonic in terms of its military power, in terms of, it is not part of the state, it's becoming a part. It has becoming increasingly a part of the state over the last 10 years. But the other faction is the major faction that is responsible in cahoots with Hezbollah's allies, like the Amal movement. So actually, people who claim the crisis today is because of Hezbollah, they're completely off the mark. But unfortunately, Hezbollah has becoming increasingly the defender of this system.
Yeah, we'll
so
come
this
back.
Is how I understand the dynamics within Lebanon at this point.
So what about France, the former colonial power? What has been its role or its involvement in Lebanon in the last few years?
France on and off as well has, you know, been involved, but it's always taken a backseat to the United States since the 60s or 70s. but we should remember that Jacques Chirac before Macron was the strongest ally of Hariri, and the most of the refinancing and restructuring conferences to rehabilitate and revive the Lebanese free market financial system was actually midwifed. It was supported by France. And so there were several conferences during Hariri's time to refinance the debt as opposed to fix it. And more recently, France has taken a proactive role since the port explosion to negotiate a kind of, you know, rehabilitation of the regime. And part of that, the reason for that, is France is very much in, has vested interest in the struggle over gas in the East Mediterranean. That's one major reason. France now is part of this East Gas Forum. France, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Italy, Cyprus, and Greece versus Turkey. So there are real material interests today by France. There's also a receding role of the United States, a relative receding role. So this is where France is stepping in. And there are some ideological affinities and, you know, after effects of colonial powers always interested, just like France behaves in West Africa, you know.
Or in Algeria.
In Algeria as well. So, you know, France always thinks that somehow it has to save this island of modernity and the Francophilia in West Asia, in the Arab world, you know. And unlike Algeria, I think you know more about Algeria. It has usually a listening audience in Lebanon. You know, there are still people and segments of the population that are very much see themselves as you know, European, and so it still has some foothold. So all three factors are leading France to be more active in trying to resolve the Lebanese crisis.
I remember at the time after the port blast, when the president, the French president Macron, went to Beirut, and in a paternalistic and neo-colonial attitude, harangueing Lebanese people and telling them, to get that shit together. But let's zoom in quickly on Hezbollah. Hezbollah is effectively running a shadow state in southern Beirut suburbs, the eastern Biqa Valley and much of South Lebanon, and is the only organized military group who can resist Israel's plans in Lebanon. It defeated Israel back in 2006. And it is for this reason that its enemies always seek to disarm the group and push for Lebanon's neutrality, which means silent complicity and normalization with Israel's oppression of Palestinians and other people in the region. However, as you said, Hezbollah has been deeply implicated in Lebanon's state failures by its participation in successive governments and has intervened in Syria in support for Assad's murderous and oppressive regime. So my question to you, Hisham, is how do we reconcile this contradiction between geopolitics on the one hand, where Hezbollah is considered as a force of resistance against Israel and Western Gulf hegemony, and the internal politics in the other, where the Islamist group is not really on the side of social economic justice agenda? Are we always forced in a way to choose the lesser evil and sacrifice demands of democracy and popular sovereignty on the altar of geopolitics?
Very good question. Although I would say, in the case of Lebanon, as I mentioned in the first question, I wouldn't say it's deeply implicated. Actually, it's a peripheral actor. It's more implicated in defending the system now. But in terms of the financial structure and crisis, it's not deeply implicated. It's actually the opposite. However, it is not interested, or it doesn't see this as its role. So it's not interested in economic reform. It doesn't believe in a socialist system. I would say, it's the whole, who are the people who are mostly implicated are the financial oligarchy and the sectarian leaders of Lebanon. So that's the first point. The second point, they are not currently, and by the way, in the case of Syria, on one hand, you're absolutely right. It has aided the regime's onslaught on the people. But here I would actually also address those opposition people and people who attack Hezbollah. Firstly, the main culprit is the Syrian regime. It wasn't the Hezbollah who put people in prison and torture and who actually, passed on rule to their son. And so, yes, Hezbollah intervened to support it, but the like I was talking in Lebanon, I'm always distinguishing between primary and secondary. So if you're interested in the long-term interest of Syria, we cannot simply be obsessed with what Hezbollah does. Actually, we are assigning it its role if we continue to simply analyze what's happening from its point of view. We should ask what kind of future we want. If there's an intersection with Hezbollah's policy towards Israel, that should be a boon, that should be an advantage. We should say, Hezbollah, we oppose your defense of the regime, but we pledge to continue the fight against Israel with you. But none of the opposition did this. Why? Because they want to ensure the support of Turkey or the United States. By the same argument, Hezbollah can say, the same way you want the support of these parties and you don't care, I also don't care. I want to protect my supply line. I want to protect the axis that's protecting me. Where were you when I was being under attack or under sanctions, etc.? Mm-hmm. So we have to step back. And first, the first step to answer your question is, they are not reconcilable today. We have to fight for ideal outcomes, but history doesn't work only to our desires. And there's, as you know, nothing Puritan or pure about history. It's a question of degree. To what extent what is being done is actually crossing red lines or not. So my point is, the first step would be to accept this contradiction. Most people don't. They either defend and actually justify everything that is done in Syria in the name of resistance, or on the other hand, they don't want to listen to the geopolitical argument and they don't care and it's all about killing innocent people. So this argument cannot happen if we don't accept first there is such a contradiction. That's the first step. How do we reconcile them? The only way I can envision is by the emergence of a political force that will take on the struggle to end authoritarian rule and somehow continue to support armed struggle against Israel. No one globally at the time is interested in supporting this any such force from both camps. So I would say the only power alternative is a domestic, a regional alternative. We haven't talked about Iraq, and we won't have time because unfortunately I think we are wrapping up. But the point is Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, the Arab East, with Egypt maybe, but more so these countries because they are now where all the wars are taking place. The only power alternative I can see that can stand up to these forces is some sort of coalition, but we can't, we're not even at the point of having a proper Syrian coalition of such forces. But my point is a regional, to gather your forces, you need a regional framework. You cannot have a just, you know, national framework. And you have to take these contradictions into your formation. But it's very, very difficult. The forces today on the ground, I don't see any such force. What we can do is at least envision this, talk about it, research it, find ways of how we can resuscitate forms of unification that do not reproduce the mistakes of Arab nationalism in the past. But much of this discussion, I find a lot of times people dismiss it. They're like, you know, this is just history. It's a, you are dismissing it at your own expense, because that's how the successful political actors are thinking right now. And I do believe it is an interest to think that way. But it's a far-fetched at this point in time, unfortunately, you know. Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. But yeah, it's a conundrum that I struggle with all the time. But I wish that leftists and other debates actually take this seriously like we are, instead of just, you know, making moral positions. If you want to be moral, you know, you can just be a pacifist. We need morality to be a part of our politics. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition of politics. We have to talk about political viability. We have to talk about contradictions. If you're just making a moral point of view about killings and fine, you know, it's commendable, but that's just a humanitarian approach to politics, which I don't think is a proper approach to a historical struggle.
Really great insights, Hisham. And I think you're touching on very, very important points that I personally, I grapple with every day. And even if the outlook is gloomy and pessimistic in the short to medium term, I think there is some optimism in the waves of uprisings and continuous resistance that we see in the regions and other parts of the world. And you're right 100% about learning from the mistakes of Arab nationalism, from the mistakes of the decolonization period, what went wrong then. I think we need always to revisit those eras, to learn from them and to be inspired and to continue thinking about, you know, strategy, politics, and politics of emancipation. So I think we touched on a lot of things, Hisham. So I thank you very much for accepting the invitation to talk to us. And I'm sure we're gonna continue the discussion in other ways. Thank you,
Hamza. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate all the important work you are doing in the Transnational Institute's attempt to provide space for these kinds of discussions. And I wish you all the best.
Thanks a lot, Hisham. Have a nice day. You take care.
Too. Bye-bye.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. This has been a conversation between Hamza Hamushen, the coordinator of TNI's North Africa program, and Hicham Safieddine, an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. Their conversation covered many themes that have already come up before here on the podcast, and links to related episodes will be shared in the description. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.